On the evening of the second day, he was lying in bed with a much clearer notion of who he was and where he was, and what had happened. At about 7 o'clock, Lucas entered the room carrying one of the dining chairs. He placed it by the bed. A moment later, Mr. Norrell entered the room and sat upon it. For some moments, Mr. Norrell did nothing but stare at the counterpane with an anxious expression. Then he muttered a question. Childermas did not hear what was said, but he naturally supposed that Mr. Norrell must be inquiring about his health, so he began to say that he hoped he would be better in a day or two. Mr. Norrell interrupted him, and said again more sharply, "Why were you performing Belus's scopus?" "What?" asked Childermas. "Lucas said that you were doing magic," said Mr. Norrell. "I made him describe it to me. Naturally, I recognized Belus's scopus." Footnote 1. The spell to detect magic appears in the instructions by Jacques Belus's. His face grew sharp and suspicious. "Why were you performing it? And, which is even more to the point, where in the world did you learn such a thing? How can I do my work when I am constantly portrayed in this manner? It is astonishing to me that I have achieved anything at all when I am surrounded by servants who learn spells behind my back and pupils who set themselves to undo my every accomplishment." Childermas gave him a look of mild exasperation. "You taught it to me yourself."
"I?"
cried Mr. Norrell, his voice several pitches higher than usual. "It was before you came to London, in the days when you kept to your library at Hurtview, when I used to go about the country for you, buying up valuable books. You taught me the spell, in case I should ever meet with anyone who claimed to be a practical magician. You were afraid that there might be another magician who could..."
"Yes, yes," said Mr. Norrell impatiently. "I remember now. But that doesn't explain why you were performing it in the square yesterday morning."
"Because there was magic everywhere."
"Lucas did not notice anything."
"It's not part of Lucas's duties to know when there's magic going on. That falls to me. It was the strangest thing I ever knew. I kept thinking that I was somewhere else entirely. I believe that for a while I was in real danger. I do not understand very well where the place was. It had some curious features, which I'll describe to you in a moment. But it was certainly not England. I think it was fairy. What sort of magic produces such an effect, and where was it coming from? Can it be that the woman was a magician?"
"Which woman?"
"The woman who shot me." Mr. Norrell made a small sound of irritation.
"That bullet affected you more than I supposed," he said contemptuously. "If she had been a great magician, do you really suppose that you could have thwarted her so easily? There was no magician in the square, certainly not that woman."
"Why? Who was she?" Mr. Norrell was silent a moment. Then he said,
"Sir Walter Pole's wife, the woman I brought back from the dead."
Childermas was silent a moment. "Well, you astonish me," he said at last. "I can think of several people who have good cause to aim a pistol at your heart, but for the life of me, I cannot understand why this woman should be one of them."
"They tell me she is mad," said Mr. Norrell. "She escaped the people who were set to watch her, and came here to kill me, which, as I think you will agree, is proof enough of her madness."
Mr. Norrell's small grey eyes looked away.
"After all, I am known everywhere as her benefactor."
Childermas was barely listening to him. "But where did she get the pistol? Sir Walter is a sensible man. It's hard to imagine that he leaves firearms in her way."
"It was a dueling pistol, one of a pair that belongs to Sir Walter. It is kept in a locked box in a locked writing desk in his private study. Sir Walter says that until yesterday he would have taken an oath that she knew nothing about it. As to how she contrived to get the key, both keys, that is a mystery to everyone."
"It does not seem much of a mystery to me. Wives, even mad wives, have ways of getting what they want from husbands."
"But Sir Walter did not have the keys. That is the strange part of it. These pistols were the only firearms in the house, and Sir Walter had some natural concerns for the security of his wife and possessions, since he is so frequently away from home. The keys were in the keeping of the butler, that tall black man. I dare say you know whom I mean. Sir Walter cannot understand how he came to make such a mistake. Sir Walter says he is generally the most reliable and trustworthy fellow in the world. Of course, one never really knows what servants are thinking," continued Mr. Norrell blithely,
forgetting that he was speaking to one at that moment.
"Yet it can hardly be supposed that this man bears any grudge against me. I never spoke 3 words to him in my life."
"Of course," he continued,
"I could prosecute Lady Pole for trying to kill me. Yesterday I was quite determined upon it. But it has been represented to me by several people that I must consider Sir Walter. Lord Liverpool and Mr. Lascelles both say so, and I believe that they are right. Sir Walter has been a good friend to English magic. I should not wish to give Sir Walter any reason to regret that he has been my friend. Sir Walter has given me his solemn oath that she will be put away somewhere in the country, where she will see no one, and no one will see her."
Mr. Norrell did not trouble to ascertain Childermas's wishes upon this point. Despite the fact that it was Childermas who was lying upon the bed sick with pain and loss of blood, and that Mr. Norrell's injuries had consisted chiefly of a slight headache and a small cut upon one finger, it was clear to Mr. Norrell that he was the more sinned against of the two.
"So what was the magic?" asked Childermas.
"Mine, of course," declared Mr. Norrell angrily. "Who else's should it be? It was the magic I did to bring her back from the dead. That was what you felt, and that is what Belus's Scopus revealed. It was early in my career, and I dare say there were some irregularities that may have caused it to take an odd turn, and..."
"An odd turn?" cried Childermas hoarsely.
He was seized with a fit of coughing. When he had regained his breath, he said,
"At every moment, I was in danger of being transported to some realm where everything breathed magic. The sky spoke to me. Everything spoke to me. How could that have been?"
Mr. Norrell raised an eyebrow.
"I do not know. Perhaps you were drunk."
"And have you ever known me to be drunk in the performance of my duties?"
asked Childermas icily. Mr. Norrell shrugged defensively.
"I have not the least idea what you do. It seems to me that you have been a law unto yourself from the first moment you entered my house."
"But surely the idea is not so strange when considered in the light of ancient English magic," insisted Childermas. "Have you not told me that Oriots regarded trees, hills, and rivers, and so on, as living creatures, with thoughts, memories, and desires of their own? The Oriots thought that the whole world habitually worked magic of a sort."
"Some of the Oriots thought so, yes. It is a belief that they imbibed from their fairy servants, who attributed some of their own extraordinary magic to their ability to talk to trees and rivers and so forth, and to form friendships and alliances with them. But there is no reason to suppose that they were right. My own magic does not rely upon any such nonsensical ideas."
"The sky spoke to me," said Childermas. "If what I saw was true, then..." He paused.
"Then what?"
asked Mr. Norrell. In his weakened state, Childermas had been thinking aloud. He had meant to say that if what he had seen was true, then everything that Strange and Norrell had ever done was child's play. A magic was a much stranger and more terrifying thing than any of them had thought of. Strange and Norrell had been merely throwing paper darts about a parlor, while real magic soared and swooped and twisted on great wings in a limitless sky far, far above them. But then he realized that Mr. Norrell was unlikely to take a very sanguine view of such ideas, and so he said nothing. Curiously, Mr. Norrell seemed to guess his thoughts anyway.
"Oh," he cried in a sudden passion, "very well. You are there, are you? Then I advise you to go and join Strange and Murray and all the other traitors immediately. I believe you will find that their ideas suit your present frame of mind much better. I'm sure that they will be very glad to have you, and you'll be able to tell them all my secrets. I dare say they will pay you handsomely for it. I shall be ruined, and—"
"Mr. Norrell, calm yourself. I've no intention of taking up any new employment. You are the last master I shall ever have."
There was another short silence, which perhaps allowed Mr. Norrell time to reflect upon the inappropriateness of quarrelling with the man who had saved his life only yesterday. In a more reasonable tone, he said,
"I dare say no one has told you yet. Strange's wife is dead."
"What?"
"Dead. I had the news from Sir Walter. Apparently she went for a walk in the snow, most ill-advised. 2 days later, she was dead."
Childermas felt cold. The dreary landscape was suddenly very close, just beneath the skin of England. He could almost fancy himself upon the ancient road again. And Arabella Strange was on the road ahead of him. Her back was turned towards him, and she walked on alone into the chill grey lands, under the magic speaking sky.
I am told,
continued Mr. Norrell, quite oblivious to Childermas's sudden pallor and laboured breathing,
that Lady Pole has been made very unhappy by the death of Mrs. Strange. Her distress has been out of all reason. It seems they were friends. I did not know that until now. Had I known it, I might perhaps have...
He paused, and his face worked with some secret emotion.
But it cannot matter now. One of them is mad, and the other one is dead. From all that Sir Walter can tell, Lady Pole seems to consider me in some way culpable for Mrs. Strange's death.
He paused. Then, in case there should be any doubt about the matter, he added,
which is nonsense, of course.
Just then, the two eminent physicians whom Mr. Norrell had employed to attend Childermas entered the room. They were surprised to see Mr. Norrell in the room, surprised and delighted. Their smiling countenances and bowing, bobbing forms said what a very pleasing instance of the great man's condescension they thought it, that he should pay this visit to his servant. They told him that they had rarely seen a household where the master was so careful of the health of his inferiors, or where the servants were so attached to their master by ties less of duty than of respect and fond regard. Mr. Morrow was at least as susceptible to flattery as most men, and he began to think that perhaps he was indeed doing something unusually virtuous. He extended his hand with the intention of patting Childermas's hand in a friendly and condescending manner. However, upon meeting Childermas's cold stare, he thought better of it, coughed, and left the room. Childermas watched him go.
All magicians lie, and this one more than most,
Vinculus had said. Chapter 47.
A black lad and a blue fella. That ought to mean summat.
Late January, 1816. Sir Walter Pole's carriage was travelling along a lonely road in Yorkshire. Stephen Black rode on a white horse at its side. On either hand, empty moors, the colour of a bruise, stretched up to a dark sky that threatened snow. Grey, misshapen rocks were strewn about, making the landscape appear still more bleak and uncouth. Occasionally, a low ray of sunlight would pierce the clouds, illuminating for a moment a white, foaming stream, or striking a pothole full of water that would suddenly become as dazzling as a fallen silver penny. They came to a crossroads. The coachman halted the horses and stared gloomily at the place where, in his opinion, the finger post ought to have been.
"There are no milestones," said Stephen. "Nothing to say where any of these roads might lead to."
"Always supposing they go anywhere at all," said the coachman, "which I'm beginning to doubt."
He took a snuff-box from his pocket and inhaled a large pinch of it. The footman, who sat on the box beside the coachman, and who was by far the coldest and most miserable of the three, comprehensively cursed Yorkshire, all Yorkshiremen, and all Yorkshire roads.
"We ought to be travelling north or northeast, I think," said Stephen, "but I've got a little turned around on this moor. Do you have any idea which way is north?"
The coachman, to whom this question was addressed, said that all the directions looked pretty northern to him. The footman gave a short, uncheerful laugh. Finding that his companions were of no help, Stephen did what he always did under such circumstances. He took the whole charge of the journey upon himself. He instructed the coachman to take one road, while he took another.
"If I have success, I will come and find you or send a messenger. If you have success, deliver your charge, and do not worry about me."
Stephen rode along, looking doubtfully at all the lanes and tracks he came to. Once he met with another lone rider and asked for directions, but the man proved to be a stranger to the moor like himself, and had never heard of the place Stephen mentioned. He came at last to a narrow lane that wound between two walls, built, as is the custom in that part of England, of dry stones without any mortar. He turned down the lane. On either hand, a row of bare winter trees followed the line of the walls. As the first flakes of snow floated down, he crossed a narrow packhorse bridge and entered a village of dour stone cottages and tumble-down walls. It was very quiet. There was scarcely more than a handful of buildings, and he quickly found the one he sought. It was a long, low hall with a paved courtyard in front of it. He surveyed the low roofs, the old-fashioned casements, and the moss-covered stones with an air of the deepest dissatisfaction. "Hello," he called. "Is there anyone there?" The snow began to fall thicker and faster. From somewhere at the side of the house, two manservants came running. They were neatly and cleanly dressed, but their nervous expressions and clumsy air made Stephen wince, and wished that he had had the training of them. For their part, they stared to see a black man upon a milk-white mare in their yard. The braver of the two bobbed a sort of half-bow. "Is this Staircross Hall?" asked Stephen.
"Yes, sir,"
said the courageous servant. "I'm here on business for Sir Walter Pole. Go and fetch your master." The man ran off. A moment later, the front door opened, and a thin, dark person appeared. "You are the madhouse keeper?" inquired Stephen. "You are John Segundus?"
"Yes, indeed," cried Mr. Segundus. "Welcome, welcome."
Stephen dismounted and threw the reins to the servant. "This place is the very devil to find. We've been driving about this infernal moor for an hour. Can you send a man to bring her ladyship's carriage here?" "They took the road to the left of this one at the crossroads, 2 miles back."
"Of course, at once," Mr. Segundus assured him. "I'm sorry you've had difficulties. The house is, as you see, extremely secluded, but that is one of the reasons that it suits Sir Walter. His lady is well, I hope?"
"Her ladyship is very much fatigued by the journey."
"Everything is ready for her reception, at least..."
Mr. Segundus led the way inside.
"I am aware that it must be very different from what she is accustomed to."
At the end of a short stone passage, they came to a room, which was a pleasant contrast with the bleak and somber surroundings. It spoke nothing but comfort and welcome. It had been fitted up with paintings and pretty furniture, with soft carpets and cheerfully glowing lamps. There were footstools for her ladyship's feet if she felt weary, screens to protect her from a draught if she felt cold, and books to amuse her, should she wish to read.
"Is it not suitable?"
asked Mr. Segundus anxiously.
"I see by your face that it is not."
Stephen opened his mouth to tell Mr. Segundus that what he saw was quite different. He saw what her ladyship would see when she entered the room. Chairs, paintings, and lamps were all quite ghostly. Behind them lay the far more substantial and solid forms of lost hopes, bleak grey halls and staircases. But it was no use trying to explain any of this. The words would have changed as he spoke them. They would have turned into some nonsense about beer brewed from anger and longings for revenge, or girls whose tears turned to opals and pearls when the moon waxed, and whose footprints filled with blood when the moon waned. So he contented himself with saying, "No, no, it is perfectly satisfactory. Her ladyship requires nothing more." To many people, this might have seemed a little cool, especially if they had worked as hard as Mr. Segundus. But Mr. Segundus made no objection.
"So this is the lady whom Mr. Norrell brought back from the dead," he said.
"Yes," said Stephen.
"The single act upon which the whole restoration of English magic is founded."
"Yes," said Stephen.
"And yet she tried to kill him. It's a very strange business altogether. Very strange."
Stephen said nothing. These were not, in his opinion, fit subjects for the madhouse keeper to ponder on, and it was most unlikely that he would hit upon the truth of the matter if he did. To draw Mr. Segundus's thoughts away from Lady Pole and her supposed crime, Stephen said, "Sir Walter chose this establishment himself. I do not know whose advice he took. Have you been a madhouse keeper long?" Mr. Segundus laughed.
"No, not long at all. About 2 weeks, in fact. Lady Pole will be my first charge."
"Indeed.
I believe Sir Walter considers my lack of experience to be an advantage rather than otherwise. Other gentlemen in this profession are accustomed to exercise all sorts of authority over their charges and impose restraints upon them, something Sir Walter is very much opposed to in the case of his wife. But you see, I have no such habits to break. Her ladyship will meet with nothing but kindness and respect in this house, and apart from such little precautions as may suggest themselves to our good sense, such as keeping guns and knives out of her way, she will be treated as a guest in this house, and we will strive to make her happy."
Stephen inclined his head in acceptance of these proposals.
"How did you come to it?" he asked.
"The house?" asked Mr. Segundus.
"No, madhouse keeping."
"Oh, quite by accident. Last September, I had the great good fortune to meet a lady called Mrs. Lennox, who has since become my benefactress. This house belongs to her. For some years she had tried to find a good tenant for it, but without success. She took a liking to me, and
wished to do me a kindness, so she determined upon establishing a business here and placing me in charge of it. Our first thought was a school for magicians, but—
Magicians? Exclaimed Stephen in surprise. But what have you to do with magicians?
Oh, I am one myself. I have been one all my life.
Indeed.
Stephen looked so very much affronted by this news that Mr. Segundus's natural impulse was to apologize to him, though what sort of apology one could offer for being a magician he did not know. He went on.
But Mr. Norrell did not approve our plan for a school, and he sent Childermas here to warn me against it. Do you know John Childermas, sir?
I know him by sight, said Stephen. I have never spoken to him.
At first, Mrs. Lennox and I had every intention of opposing him. Mr. Norrell, I mean, not Childermas. I wrote to Mr. Strange, but my letter arrived on the morning that his wife disappeared, and as I dare say you know, the poor lady died a few days later.
For a moment Stephen looked as if he were about to say something, but then he shook his head, and Mr. Segundus continued.
Without Mr. Strange to help us, it was clear to me that we must abandon the school. I travelled up to Bath to inform Mrs. Lennox. She was full of kindness, and told me we would soon fix on another plan. But I confess, I left her house in a very despondent frame of mind. I had not gone many steps when I saw a strange sight. In the middle of the road was a figure in tattered black rags. His sore, reddened eyes were empty of all reason and hope. He dashed his arms against the phantoms that assaulted him, and cried out, entreating them to have pity on him. Poor soul, the sick in body may sometimes find respite in sleep, but I know instinctively that this man's demons would follow him even into his dreams. I put a few coins into his hand and continued on my way. I'm not aware that I thought of him particularly on the journey back, but as I stepped across the threshold of this house, something very curious happened. I had what I think I must call a vision. I saw the madman in all his ravings, standing in the hall just as I had seen him in Bath, and I realized something. I realized that this house with its silence and its seclusion might be kind to persons distressed in mind. I wrote to Mrs. Lennox, and she approved my new plan. You said you did not know who had recommended me to Sir Walter. It was Childermas. Childermas had said he would help me if he could.
Stephen said, It might be best, sir, if you were to avoid any mention of your profession or of the school, at least at the beginning. There is nothing in the world, in this world or any other, that would give her ladyship greater pain than to find herself in thrall to another magician.
Thrall? Exclaimed Mr. Segundus in astonishment. What an odd word that is. I sincerely hope that no one will ever consider themselves in thrall to me. Certainly not this lady.
Stephen studied him for a moment.
I'm sure you're a very different sort of magician from Mr. Norrell, he said.
I hope I am, said Mr. Segundus seriously.
An hour later, a little commotion was heard in the yard. Stephen and Mr. Segundus went out to receive her ladyship. The horses and carriage had been entirely unable to cross the packhorse bridge, and Lady Pole had been obliged to walk the last 50 yards or so of her journey. She entered the courtyard of the hall with some trepidation, glancing round at the bleak, snowy scene, and it seemed to Stephen that only the cruelest of hearts could look upon her, with all her youth, beauty, and sad affliction, and not wish to offer her all the protection in their power. Inwardly, he cursed Mr. Norrell. Something in her appearance seemed to startle Mr. Segundus. He looked down at her left hand, but the hand was gloved. He recovered himself immediately and welcomed her to Staircross Hall. In the drawing-room, Stephen brought tea for them.
"I am told your ladyship has been greatly distressed by the death of Mrs. Strange," said Mr. Segundus. "May I offer my condolences?"
She turned away her head to hide her tears.
"It would be more to the point to offer them to her, not me," she said. "My husband offered to write to Mr. Strange and beg the favor of borrowing a picture of Mrs. Strange so that a copy might be made to console me. But what good would that do? After all, I am scarcely likely to forget her face when she and I attend the same balls and processions every night, and shall do for the rest of our lives. I presume Stephen knows. Stephen understands. Yes, said Mr. Segundus. Your ladyship has a horror of dancing and music, I know. Be assured that they will not be allowed here. Here we shall have nothing that is not cheerful, nothing that does not promote your happiness.
He spoke to her of the books he had planned they should read together, and the walks they would take in spring, if her ladyship liked. To Stephen, occupied among the tea-things, it seemed the most innocuous of conversations, except that once or twice he observed Mr. Segundus glance from her ladyship to himself and back again, in a sharp, penetrating manner that both puzzled him and made him uncomfortable. The carriage, coachman, maid, and footman were all to remain at Staircross Hall with Lady Pole. Stephen, however, was to return to Harley Street. Early the next morning, while her ladyship was at breakfast, he went in to take his leave of her. As he bowed to her, she gave a laugh, half melancholy, half amused.
"It is very ridiculous to part so, when you and I both know that we will be together again in a few hours. Do not be concerned about me, Stephen. I shall be more comfortable here. I feel I shall."
Stephen went out to the stable yard, where his horse stood waiting. He was just putting on his gloves when a voice came behind him.
"I beg your pardon."
Mr. Segundus was there, as hesitant and unassuming as ever.
"May I ask you something? What is the magic that surrounds you and her ladyship?"
He put up his hand as if he intended to brush Stephen's face with his fingertips.
"There is a red and white rose at your mouth, and another at hers. What does that mean?"
Stephen put his hand up to his mouth. There was nothing there. But for a moment, he had some wild notion of telling Mr. Segundus everything, all about his enchantment and the enchantment of the two women. He pictured Mr. Segundus somehow understanding him. Mr. Segundus proving to be an extraordinary magician, much greater than Strange or Norrell, who would find a way to thwart the gentleman with the thistle-down hair. But these were very fleeting fancies. A moment later, Stephen's native distrust of Englishmen, and of English magicians in particular, reasserted itself. "I do not understand you," he said quickly. He mounted his horse and rode away without another word. The winter roads that day were some of the worst he had ever seen. The mud had been frozen into ruts and ridges as hard as iron. Fields and roads were thickly covered with white frost, and an icy mist added to the general gloom. His horse was one of the gentleman's innumerable gifts. She was a milk-white mare, without so much as a single black hair anywhere. She was, besides, swift and strong, and as affectionately disposed towards Stephen as a horse can be to a man. He had named her Firenze, and he doubted that the Prince Regent himself, or the Duke of Wellington, had a better horse. It was one of the peculiarities of his strange, enchanted life, that it did not matter where he went. No one remarked upon the incongruity of a negro servant possessing the finest horse in the kingdom. About 20 miles south of Staircross Hall, he came to a small village. There was a sharp corner, as the road passed between a large, elegant house and garden upon the right, and a row of tumble-down stables upon the left. Just as Stephen was passing the entrance to the house, a carriage came suddenly out of the sweep and nearly collided with him. The coachman looked around to see what had caused his horses to shy and forced him to rein them in. Seeing nothing but a black man, he lashed out at him with his whip. The blow missed Stephen, but struck Firenze just above the right eye. Pained and startled, she reared up and lost her footing on the icy road. There was a moment when everything seemed to tumble over. When Stephen was next able to comprehend what was happening, he found that he was on the ground. Firenze had fallen. He had been thrown clear, but his left foot was still caught in the stirrup, and the leg was twisted in the most alarming way. He was sure it must be broken. He freed his foot and sat for a moment feeling sick and stunned. There was a sensation of something wet trickling down his face, and his hands had been scraped raw by the fall. He tried to stand and found with relief that he could. The leg seemed bruised, but not broken. Firenze lay snorting, her eyes rolling wildly. He wondered why she did not try to right herself, or at least kick out. A sort of involuntary shuddering possessed her frame, but apart from that, she was still. Her legs were stiff and seemed to stick out at awkward angles to each other. Then it came to him. She could not move. Her back was broken. He looked at the gentleman's house, hoping that someone would come and help him. A woman appeared for a moment at a window. Stephen had a brief impression of elegant clothes and a cold, haughty expression. As soon as she had satisfied herself that the accident had produced no harm to anyone or anything belonging to her, she moved away, and Stephen saw no more of her. He knelt down by Ferenczi and stroked her head and shoulder. From out of a saddlebag, he drew a pistol, a powder flask, a ramrod, and a cartridge. He loaded and primed the pistol. Then he stood and drew the hammer back to full cock. But he found he could go no further. She had been too good a friend to him. He could not kill her. He was on the point of giving up in despair when there was a rattle in the lane behind him. Around the corner came a cart drawn by a great shambling, placid-looking horse. It was a carrier's cart, and in the cart sat the carrier himself, a big barrel-shaped man with a round, fat face. He was dressed in an ancient coat. When he saw Stephen, he reined in his horse.
"Here, lad, what's to do?"
Stephen gestured at Ferenczi with the pistol. Carrier climbed down from his cart and came over to Stephen.
"She was a pretty beast," he said in a kindly tone.
He clapped Stephen on the shoulder and breathed sympathetic cabbage smells over him.
"But, lad, I cannot help her now."
He looked from Stephen's face to the pistol. He reached out and gently raised the barrel until it pointed at Ferenczi's shuddering head. When Stephen did not fire, he said,
"Shall I do it for thee, lad?"
Stephen nodded. Carrier took the pistol. Stephen looked away. There was a shot, a horrible sound, followed immediately by a wild cawing and the rush of wings, as all the birds in the neighborhood took flight at once. Stephen looked back. Ferenczi convulsed once, and then was still. "Thank you," he said to the carrier. He heard the carrier walk away, and he thought the man was gone. But in a moment he returned, nudged Stephen again, and handed him a black bottle. Stephen swallowed. It was gin of the roughest sort. He coughed. Despite the fact that the cost of Stephen's clothes and boots could have bought the carrier's cart and horse twice over, the carrier assumed the cheerful superiority that white generally feels for black. He considered the matter and told Stephen that the first thing they must do was to arrange for the carcass to be removed.
"She's a valuable beast, dead or alive. Your master won't be best pleased when he finds some other fella has got to horse and to money."
"She was not my master's horse," said Stephen. "She was mine."
"Eh?" said the carrier. "Look at that."
A raven had alighted upon Ferenczi's milk-white flank.
"No," cried Stephen, and moved to shoo the bird away. But the carrier stopped him.
"Nay, lad, nay. That's lucky. I do not know when I saw a better omen."
"Lucky," said Stephen. "What are you talking about?"
"'Tis the sign of the old king, ain't it? A raven upon summit white. Old John's banner."
Footnote 1. John Usklass's arms were the raven in flight, properly called the raven Volant, a black raven on a white field. The carrier informed Stephen that he knew of a place close by where, he said, the people would, for a price, help Stephen make arrangements for disposing of Ferenczi. Stephen climbed upon the box, and the carrier drove him to a farm. The farmer had never seen a black man before, and was quite astonished to find such an otherlandish creature in his yard. Despite all evidence to the contrary, he could not bring himself to believe that Stephen was speaking English. The carrier, who sympathized with the farmer in his confusion, stood beside Stephen, kindly repeating everything he said for the farmer's better understanding. But it made no difference. The farmer took no notice of either of them, but merely gaped at Stephen and made remarks about him to one of his men, who stood equally entranced. The farmer wondered whether the black came off when Stephen touched things, and he made other speculations of an even more impertinent and disagreeable nature. All Stephen's careful instructions concerning the disposal of Ferenczi's carcass went for nothing, until the farmer's wife returned from a nearby market. She was a very different sort of person. As far as she was concerned, a man in good clothes with a costly horse, albeit a dead one, counted for a gentleman, let him be whatsoever color he chose. She told Stephen of a cat's meat man who took the dead horses from the farm and who would dispose of the flesh and sell the bones and hooves for glue. She told him what the cat's meat man would pay and promised to arrange everything if she could keep one-third of the money. To this, Stephen agreed. Stephen and the carrier came out of the farmyard into the lane. "Thank you," said Stephen. "This would have been much more difficult without your help. I will pay you for your trouble, of course, but I fear I must trouble you further. I have no means of getting home. I would be very much obliged if you could take me as far as the next post-in."
"Nay," said the carrier. "Put the little purse away, lad. I'll take thee to Doncaster, and I'll cost thee nought."
In truth, Stephen would have preferred to go to the next post-in, but the carrier seemed so pleased to have found a companion that it seemed kinder and more grateful to go with him. The cart progressed towards Doncaster by degrees, travelling along country lanes and coming at inns and villages from odd directions, taking them by surprise. They delivered a bedstead in this place and a fruitcake in that place, and took up no end of oddly shaped parcels. Once they stopped at a very small cottage that stood by itself behind a high bare hedge in the middle of a wood. There they received from the hands of an ancient maid a bony old black-painted birdcage containing a very small canary. The carrier informed Stephen that it had belonged to an old lady who had died, and it was to be delivered to her great-niece south of Selby. Not long after the canary had been secreted in the back of the carriage, Stephen was startled by a series of thunderous snores issuing unexpectedly from the same place. It seemed impossible that such a very loud noise should have come out of such a very small bird, and Stephen concluded that there was another person in the cart, someone he had not yet been privileged to see. The carrier produced from a basket a large pork pie and a hunk of cheese. He cut a piece off the pie with a large knife and seemed about to offer it to Stephen when he was struck by a doubt. "Do black lads eat the same as us?" he asked, as if he thought they might possibly eat grass or moonbeams. "Yes," said Stephen. The carrier gave Stephen the piece of pie and some cheese. "Thank you. Does not your other passenger want something?"
"He might, when he wakes. I took him up at Ripon. He'd no money. I thought as how he'd be someone to talk to. He were chatty enough at first, but he went to sleep at Boroughbridge, and he's done nought else since. Very tiresome of him. I don't mind it. I have you to talk to now."
"He must be very tired," mused Stephen. "He has slept through the shot that finished my horse, the visit to the foolish farmer, the bedstead and the canary, all the events of the day, in fact. Where is he going?"
"Em? Nowhere. He wanders about from place to place. He's persecuted by some famous man in London, and cannot stay long anywhere, or t'other chap's servant might catch up with him."
"Indeed."
"He is blue," remarked the carrier.
"Blue," said Stephen, mystified. The carrier nodded. "What, blue with cold, or has he been beaten?"
"Nay, lad. He is as blue as thou art black. Aye, I have a black lad and a blue feller in my cart. I never heard of anyone that did that before. Now, if to see a black lad is good luck, which it must be, like cats, then to see a black lad and a blue feller together in one place ought to mean something. But what?"
"Perhaps it does mean something," offered Stephen. "But not for you. Perhaps it means something for him, or me."
"Nay, that can't be right," objected the carrier. "It's me it's happening to."
Stephen considered the unknown man's odd colour. "Does he have a disease?" he asked.
"Could be," said the carrier,
unwilling to commit himself. After they'd eaten, the carrier began to nod, and pretty soon he was fast asleep with the reins in his hands. The cart continued serenely along the road under the captainship of the horse, a beast of excellent sense and judgment. It was a weary journey for Stephen. The sad exile of Lady Pole and the loss of Firenze depressed his spirits. He was glad to be relieved of the carrier's conversation for a while. Once he heard a sort of muttering, suggesting that the blue man was waking up. At first he could not tell what the blue man was saying, and then he heard very clearly,
"The nameless slave shall be king in a strange country."
That made him shiver. It reminded him so forcibly of the gentleman's promise to make him king of England. It grew dark. Stephen halted the horse, got down from the box, and lit the three ancient lanterns that hung about the cart. He was about to get back upon the box when a ragged, unkempt-looking fellow climbed suddenly out of the back and jumped down upon the icy ground to stand in front of him. The unkempt person regarded Stephen by the lantern's light.
Are we there yet?
He asked in a hoarse tone.
Are we where? Asked Stephen.
The man considered this for a moment, and then decided to rephrase his original question.
Where are we?
He asked.
Nowhere. Between somewhere called Ulskelf and another place called Thorpe Willoughby, I believe.
Though the man had asked for this information, he did not seem much interested in it when it was given to him. His dirty shirt was open to the waist, and Stephen could see that the carrier's description of him had been of a most misleading nature. He was not blue in the same way that Stephen was black. He was a thin, disreputable hawk of a man, whose skin in its natural state ought to have been the same color as every other Englishman's. But it was covered in a strange patterning of blue lines, flourishes, dots, and circles.
Do you know John Childermas, the magician's servant?
He asked. Stephen was startled, as anybody would be who was asked the same question twice in 2 days by complete strangers.
I know him by sight. I have never spoken with him.
The man grinned and winked.
He has been looking for me for 8 years. Never found me yet. I've been to look at his master's house in Yorkshire. It stands in a great park. I should have liked to steal something. When I was at his house in London, I ate some pies.
It was a little disconcerting to find oneself in the company of a self-confessed thief, yet Stephen could not help but feel some sort of fellowship with someone who wished to rob the magician. After all, if it had not been for Mr. Norrell, Lady Pole and he would never have fallen under an enchantment. He reached into his pocket and pulled out 2 crown coins. Here, he said.
And what is that for?
Asked the man suspiciously, but he took the coins anyway.
I'm sorry for you.
Why?
Because if what I am told is true, you have no home. The man grinned again and scratched his dirty cheek.
And if what I am told is true, you have no name.
What?
I have a name. It is Vinculus.
He grabbed Stephen's hand.
Why do you try to pull away from me?
I do not, said Stephen.
Yes, you did, just then.
Stephen hesitated. Your skin is marked and discolored. I thought perhaps the marks meant you had a disease of some sort.
That is not what my skin means, said Vinculus.
Means, said Stephen. That is an odd word to use. Yet it is true. Skin can mean a great deal. Mine means that any man may strike me in a public place and never fear the consequences. It means that my friends do not always like to be seen with me in the street. It means that no matter how many books I read or languages I master, I will never be anything but a curiosity, like a talking pig or a mathematical horse. Vinculus grinned.
And mine means the opposite of yours. It means you will be raised up on high, nameless king. It means your kingdom is waiting for you, and your enemy shall be destroyed. It means the hour is almost come. The nameless slave shall wear a silver crown. The nameless slave shall be a king in a strange country.
Then, keeping tight hold of Stephen's hand, Vinculus recited the whole of his prophecy.
There, he said when he was done. Now I have told it to the 2 magicians, and I've told it to you. The first part of my task is done.
But I am not a magician, said Stephen.
I never said you were,
answered Vinculus. Without warning, he released Stephen's arm, pulled his ragged coat tight around him, plunged into the darkness beyond the glow of the lanterns, and was gone. A few days later, the gentleman with the thistledown hair expressed a sudden desire to see a wolf hunt, something he had apparently not done for several centuries. There happened to be one going on in southern Sweden just then, and so he instantly transported himself and Stephen to the place. Stephen found himself standing upon a great branch that belonged to an ancient oak in the midst of a snowy forest. From here he had an excellent view of a little clearing where a tall wooden pole had been planted in the ground. On top of the pole was an old wooden cartwheel, and on top of the cartwheel a young goat was securely tied. It bleated miserably. A family of wolves crept out of the trees, with frost and snow clogging their fur, their gaze fixed hungrily upon the goat. No sooner had they appeared than dogs could be heard in every part of the forest, and riders could be glimpsed approaching at great speed.
A pack of hounds came pouring into the clearing. The two foremost dogs leapt upon a wolf, and together the three creatures became a single snapping, snarling, biting, thrashing knot of bodies, legs, and teeth. The hunters galloped up and shot the wolf. The other wolves went streaming into the dark trees, and the dogs and hunters followed. As soon as the sport waned in one place, the gentleman carried himself and Stephen through the air by magic to wherever it was likely to be better. In this fashion, they progressed from treetop to treetop, from hill to rocky outcrop. Once, they travelled to the top of a church tower in a village of wooden houses, where the windows and doors were made in quaint fairy-tale shapes, and the roofs were dusted with powdery snow that glittered in the sunlight. They were waiting in a quiet part of the wood for the hunters to appear, when a single wolf passed by their tree. He was the handsomest of his kind, with fine dark eyes and a pelt the colour of wet slate. He looked up into the tree and addressed the gentleman in a language that sounded like the chatter of water over stones and the sighing of wind among bare branches and the crackle of fire consuming dead leaves. The gentleman answered him in the same speech, then gave a careless laugh and waved him away with his hand. The wolf bestowed one last reproachful glance upon the gentleman and ran on.
"He begs me to save him," the gentleman explained.
"Oh, could you not do it, sir? I hate to see these noble creatures die."
"Tender-hearted Stephen," said the gentleman fondly.
But he did not save the wolf. Stephen was not enjoying the wolf hunt at all. True, the hunters were brave, and the hounds were faithful and eager. But it was too soon after the loss of Firenze for him to take pleasure in the deaths of any creature, especially one as strong and handsome as the wolf. Thinking of Firenze reminded him that he had not yet told the gentleman about his meeting with the blue-skinned man in the cart and the prophecy. He did so now.
"Really? Well, that is most unexpected," declared the gentleman.
"Have you heard this prophecy before, sir?"
"Yes, indeed. I know it well. All my race do. It is a prophecy of..."
Here the gentleman said a word which Stephen did not understand. Footnote 2. Presumably the Raven King's original Sidhe name, which Jonathan Strange thought meant starling.
"Whom you know better by his English name, Jan Usklas, the Raven King. But what I do not understand is how it has survived in England. I did not think Englishmen interested themselves in such matters any more."
"The nameless slave? Well, that is me, sir, is it not? And this prophecy seems to tell how I will be a king."
"Of course you're going to be a king. I have said so, and I am never wrong in these matters. But dearly as I love you, Stephen, this prophecy does not refer to you at all. Most of it is about the restoration of English magic, and the part you have just recited is not really a prophecy at all. The king is remembering how he came into his three kingdoms, one in England, one in Faerie, one in Hell. By the nameless slave, he means himself. He was the nameless slave in Faerie, the little Christian child hidden in the brewer, brought there by a very wicked fairy who had stolen him away out of England."
Stephen felt oddly disappointed, though he did not know why he should be. After all, he did not wish to be king of anywhere. He was not English. He was not African. He didn't belong anywhere. Vinculus's words had briefly given him the sense of belonging to something, of being part of a pattern and of having a purpose. But it had all been illusory. Chapter 48. The Engravings. Late February to March, 1816.
"You're changed. I'm quite shocked to see you."
"Am I? You surprise me. I am perhaps a little thinner, but I'm not aware of any other change."
"No, it's in your face, your air, your something."
Strange smiled. Or rather, he twisted something in his face, and Sir Walter supposed that he was smiling. Sir Walter could not really recall what his smile had looked like before. "It is these black clothes," said Strange. "I'm like a leftover piece of the funeral, condemned to walk about the town, frightening people into thinking of their own mortality." They were in the Bedford Coffee House in Covent Garden, chosen by Sir Walter as a place where they had often been very merry in the past, and which might therefore do something to cheer strangers' spirits. But on such an evening as this, even the Bedford was somewhat deficient in cheerfulness. Outside, a cold black wind was pulling people this way and that, and driving a thick black rain into their eyes. Inside, rooms full of damp, unhappy gentlemen were producing a kind of gloomy, domesticated fog, which the waiters were attempting to dispel by putting extra shovelfuls of coal on the fire and getting extra glassfuls of hot spiced wine into the gentlemen. When Sir Walter had come into the room, he had discovered Strange writing furiously in a little book. He nodded towards the book and remarked,
"You've not given up magic, then?"
Strange laughed. Sir Walter took this to mean he had not, which Sir Walter was glad of, for Sir Walter thought a great deal of a man's having a profession and believed that useful, steady occupation might cure many things which other remedies could not. Only he did not quite like the laugh, a hard, bitter exclamation which he had never heard from Strange before.
"It's just that you said," he began.
"Oh, I said a great many things. All sorts of odd ideas crept into my brain. Excessive grief may bring on quite as fine a bout of madness as an excess of anything else. Truth to tell, I was not quite myself for a time. Truth to tell, I was a little wild. But as you see, that is all past now." But, truth to tell, Sir Walter did not see at all. It was not quite enough to say that Strange had changed. In some senses, he was just what he'd always been. He smiled as often as before, though it was not quite the same smile. He spoke in the same ironic, superficial tone as he had always done, while giving the impression of scarcely attending to his own words. His words and his face were what all his friends remembered, with this difference, that the man behind them seemed only to be acting a part, while his thoughts and his heart were somewhere else entirely. He looked out at them all from behind the sarcastic smile, and none of them knew what he was thinking. He was more like a magician than ever before. It was very curious, and no one knew what to make of it. But in some ways, he was more like Norrell. He wore a mourning ring on the fourth finger of his left hand, with a thin strand of brown hair inside it, and Sir Walter noticed that he continually touched it and turned it upon his finger. They ordered a good dinner, consisting of a turtle, 3 or 4 beefsteaks, some gravy made with the fat of a green goose, some lampreys, escalloped oysters, and a small salad of beetroot. "I'm glad to be back," said Strange. "Now that I'm here, I intend to make as much mischief as I can. Norrell has had everything his own way for far too long.
He is already in agonies whenever your book is mentioned. He is forever inquiring of people if they know what is in it."
"Oh, but the book is only the beginning. And besides, it will not be ready for months. We are to have a new periodical. Murray wishes to bring it forward as quickly as possible. Naturally, it will be a very superior production. It is to be called The Famulus." Footnote 1. A famulus, a Latin word meaning a servant, especially the servant of a magician, and is intended to promote my views on magic.
"And these are very different from Norrell's, are they?"
"But of course. My chief idea is to examine the subject rationally, without any of the restrictions and limitations that Norrell imposes upon it. I am confident that such a re-examination will rapidly open up new avenues worthy of exploration. For when you consider the matter, what does our so-called restoration of English magic amount to? What have Norrell and I actually done? Some weaving of illusions with clouds, rain, smoke, etc. The easiest things in the world to accomplish. Bestowing life and speech upon inanimate objects. Well, I grant you, that is quite sophisticated. Sending storms and bad weather to our enemies. I really cannot emphasize how simple weather magic is. What else? Summoning up visions. Well, that might be impressive if either of us could manage it with any degree of skill, but neither of us can. Now, compare that sorry reckoning with the magic of the Oriots. They persuaded Sycamore and Oakwoods to join with them against their enemies. They made wives and servants for themselves out of flowers. They transformed themselves into mice, foxes, trees, rivers, etc. They made ships out of cobwebs, houses out of rose bushes.
Yes, interrupted Sir Walter. "I understand that you are impatient to try all these different sorts of magic. But though I do not much like saying it, it seems to me that Norrell may be right. Not all these sorts of magic will suit us nowadays. Shape-changing and so on were all very well in the past. It makes a vivid incident in a story, I grant you. But surely, Strange,
You would not want to practice it. A gentleman cannot change his shape. A gentleman scorns to seem anything other than what he is. You yourself would never wish to appear in the character of a pastry cook or a lamplighter.
Strange laughed.
Well then, said Sir Walter, consider how much worse it would be to appear as a dog or a pig.
Footnote 2. Sir Walter is voicing a commonly held concern. Shape-changing magic has always been regarded with suspicion. The Oriots generally employed it during their travels in Faerie or other lands beyond England. They were aware that shape-changing magic was particularly liable to abuses of every sort. For example, in London in 1232, a nobleman's wife called Cecily de Walbrook found a handsome pewter-coloured cat scratching at her bedchamber door. She took it in and named it Sir Loveday. It ate from her hand and slept upon her bed. What was even more remarkable, it followed her everywhere, even to church, where it sat curled up in the hem of her skirts, purring. Then one day she was seen in the street with Sir Loveday by a magician called Walter de Shep. His suspicions were immediately aroused. He approached Cecily and said, "Lady, the cat that follows you, I fear it is no cat at all." Two other magicians were fetched, and Walter and the others set spells over Sir Loveday. He turned back into his true shape, that of a minor magician called Jocelyn de Snitten. Shortly afterwards, Jocelyn was tried by the petty dragoons of London and sentenced to have his right hand cut off. You are deliberately choosing low examples.
Am I? Or a lion, then? Would you like to be a lion?
Possibly, perhaps, probably not. But that is not the point. I agree that shape-changing is a sort of magic which requires delicate handling, but that is not to say that some useful application might not exist. Ask the Duke of Wellington whether he would have liked to be able to turn his exploring officers into foxes or mice and have them slip about the French camps. I assure you, His Grace will not be so full of qualms.
I do not think you could have persuaded Colquhoun Grant to become a fox.
Footnote 3. It has already been described how Lieutenant Colonel Colquhoun Grant's devotion to his scarlet uniform had led to his capture by the French in 1812. Oh, Grant would not have minded being a fox, as long as he could have been a fox in uniform. Oh, no, we need to turn our attention to the Oriots. A great deal more energy ought to be applied to the study of the life and magic of John Usklask. And when we do,
well, that is one thing you must not do. Do not even think of it.
What are you talking about?
I'm serious, Strange. I say nothing against the Oriots in general. Indeed, upon the whole, I think you're right. Englishmen take great pride in their ancient magical history. In God Bless, Stokesy, Pale, and the rest. They do not like to read in their newspapers that Norrell makes light of their achievements. But you are liable to fall into the opposite mistake. Too much talk of other kings is bound to make the government nervous, particularly when we're liable to be overrun by Johannites at any moment.
Johannites? Who are the Johannites?
What? Good Lord, Strange, do you never look into a newspaper?
Strange looked a little put out. My studies take up a great deal of my time, all of it, in fact. And besides, you know, in the past month I complete distractions of a very particular nature.
But we're not speaking of the past month. There have been Johannites in the northern counties for 4 years.
Oh, yes, but who are they?
They're craftsmen who creep into mills at dead of night and destroy property. They burn down factory owners' houses. They hold pernicious meetings inciting the common people to riotous acts. And they loot marketplaces.
Footnote 4. The common people in northern England considered that they had suffered a great deal in recent years, and with good reason. Poverty and lack of employment had added to the general misery which the war with the French had produced. Then, just when the war was over, a new threat to their happiness had arisen. Remarkable new machines which produced all sorts of goods cheaply and put them out of work. It is scarcely to be wondered at that certain individuals among them had taken to destroying the machines in an attempt to preserve their livelihoods.
Oh, machine breakers. Yes, I understand you now. It's just that you misled me by that odd name. But what have machine breakers to do with the Raven King? Well, many of them are, or rather claim to be, his followers. They daub the raven in flight upon every wall where property is destroyed. Their captains carry letters of commission purporting to come from John Usklas, and they say that he will shortly appear to re-establish his reign in Newcastle.
And the government believes them? Asked Strange in astonishment.
Well, of course not. We're not so ridiculous. What we fear is a great deal more mundane. In a word, revolution. John Usglass's banner is flying everywhere in the north from Nottingham to Newcastle. Of course, we have our spies and informers to tell us what these fellows are doing and thinking. Oh, I don't say that they all believe that John Usglass is coming back. Most are as rational as you or I. But they know the power of his name among the common people. Rowley Fisher-Drake, the member for Hampshire, has brought forward a bill in which he proposes to make it illegal to raise the Raven in flight. But we can't forbid people to fly their own flag, the flag of their legitimate king.
Footnote 5. There could be no neater illustration than this of the curious relationship in which the government in London stood to the northern half of the kingdom. The government represented the King of England, but the King of England was only the king of the southern half. Legally, he was the steward of the northern half, maintaining the rule of law until such time as John Usglass chose to return. Sir Walter sighed and poked a beefsteak upon his plate with a fork.
"Other countries," he said, "have stories of kings who will return at times of great need. Only in England is it part of the constitution."
Strange waved a fork impatiently at the minister.
"But all that is politics. It's nothing to do with me. I'm not going to call for the re-establishment of John Usglass's kingdom. My only wish is to examine, in a calm and rational manner, his accomplishments as a magician.
How can we restore English magic until we understand what it is we're supposed to be restoring?
Then study the Oreads, but leave John Usglass in the obscurity in which Norrell has placed him."
Strange shook his head. "Norrell has poisoned your minds against John Usglass. Norrell has bewitched you all." They ate in silence for a while, and then Strange said, "Did I ever tell you that there is a portrait of him at Windsor Castle?"
"Who?"
"Usglass. A fanciful scene painted upon a wall in one of the staterooms by some Italian painter. It shows Edward III and John Usglass, warrior king and magician king, seated side by side. It's been almost 400 years since John Usglass went out of England, and still the English cannot quite make up their minds whether to adore him or hate him."
"Ah," exclaimed Sir Walter, "in the north they know exactly what to think of him. They would exchange the rule of Westminster for his rule tomorrow, if they could."
Footnote 6. Naturally, at various times, pretenders have arisen claiming to be John Usglass, and have attempted to take back the kingdom of northern England. The most famous of these was a young man called Jack Farrow, who was crowned in Durham Cathedral in 1487. He had the support of a large number of northern noblemen, and also of a few fairies who remained at the king's city of Newcastle. Farrow was a very handsome man with a kingly bearing. He could do simple magic, and his fairy supporters were quick to do more whenever he was present, and to attribute it to him. He was the son of a pair of vagabond magicians. While still a child, he was seen at a fair by the Earl of Hexham, who noted his striking resemblance to descriptions of John Usglass. Hexham paid the boy's parents 7 shillings for him. Farrow never saw them again. Hexham kept him at a secret place in northern England, where he was trained in kingly arts. In 1486, the Earl produced Farrow, and he began his brief reign as King of Northern England. Farrow's main problem was that too many people knew about the deception. Farrow and Hexham soon quarrelled. In 1490, Hexham was murdered on Farrow's orders. Hexham's 4 sons joined with Henry VII of southern England to attack Farrow, and at the Battle of Worksop in 1493, Farrow was defeated. Farrow was kept in the Tower of London and executed in 1499. Other pretenders, more or less successful, were Piers Blackmore and Davy Sanchausseur. The last pretender was known simply as the Summer King, since his true identity was never discovered. He first appeared near Sunderland in May 1536, shortly after Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries. It's thought that he may have been a monk from one of the great northern abbeys, Fountains, Revolts, or Hertfew. The Summer King differed from Farrow and Blackmore in that he had no support from the northern aristocracy, nor did he attempt to gain any. His appeal was to the common people. In some ways, his career was more mystical than magical. He healed the sick and taught his followers to revere nature and wild creatures, a creed which seems closer to the teachings of the 12th century magician Thomas Godbless than anything John Usglass ever proposed. His ragged band made no attempt to capture Newcastle, or indeed to capture anything at all.
All through the summer of 1536, they wandered about northern England, gaining supporters wherever they appeared. In September, Henry VIII sent an army against them. They were not equipped to fight. Most ran away back to their homes, but a few remained and fought for their king, and were massacred at Pontefract. The summer king may have been among the dead, or he may have simply vanished. A week or so later, the first issue of The Famulus was published, and owing to the sensational nature of one of the articles, the entire run sold out within 2 days. Mr. Murray, who was soon to publish the first volume of Strange's The History and Practice of English Magic, was filled with a happy anticipation of making a very large profit. The article, which so thrilled the public, was a description of how magicians might summon up dead people for the purposes of learning useful information from them. This shocking but deeply interesting subject caused such a sensation that several young ladies were reported to have fainted merely upon learning that the Famulus was in the house. Footnote 7. Consulting dead magicians may strike us as highly sensational, but it is a magical procedure with a perfectly respectable history. Martin Pale claimed to have learnt magic from Catherine of Winchester, who was a pupil of John Usglass. Catherine of Winchester died 200 years before Martin Pale was born. John Usglass himself was reputed to have had conversations with Merlin, the Witch of Endor, Moses and Aaron, Joseph of Arimathea, and other venerable and ancient magicians. No one could imagine Mr. Norrell ever approving such a publication, and so everybody who didn't like Mr. Norrell took a particular pleasure in buying a copy. In Hanover Square, Mr. Lascelles read it out loud for the benefit of Mr. Norrell. "Where the magician is deficient in skill and knowledge, and this must include all modern magicians, our national genius in such matters being sadly fallen off from what it was in former times, then he or she might be best advised to conjure up the spirit of someone who was in life a magician or had at least some talent for the art. For, if we are uncertain of the path ourselves, it is best to call on someone in possession of a little knowledge and who is able, as it were, to meet us halfway."
"He will undo everything," cried Norrell with a wild passion. "He is determined to destroy me."
"It is certainly very aggravating," remarked Lascelles, with all the calm in the world, "and after he swore to Sir Walter that he had given up magic when his wife died."
"We might all die. Half of London might be swept away, but Strange will always do magic. He cannot help himself. He is too much a magician ever to stop now, and the magic that he would do is evil. I do not know how I shall prevent him."
"Pray calm yourself, Mr. Norrell," said Lascelles. "I am sure you will soon think of something."
"When is his book to be published?"
"Murray's advertisements say that the first volume will appear in August."
"The first volume?"
"Oh, yes. Did you not know? It will be a 3-volume work. The first volume lays before the public the complete history of English magic. The second volume furnishes them with a precise understanding of its nature, and the third provides the foundation for its future practice." Mr. Norrell groaned aloud, bowed his head, and hid his face in his hands. "Of course," said Lascelles thoughtfully. "As mischievous as the text undoubtedly will be, what I find even more alarming are the engravings."
"Engravings?" cried Mr. Norrell, aghast. "What engravings are these?"
"Oh," said Lascelles, "a stranger's discovered some emigrant or other who has studied under all the best masters of Italy, France, and Spain, and he's paying this man a most extravagant amount of money to make the engravings."
"But what are they of? What is the subject?"
"What indeed?" said Lascelles with a yawn. "I have not the least idea." He took up the Famulus again and began to read silently to himself. Mr. Norrell sat for some time deep in thought, chewing at his fingernails. By and by, he rang the bell and sent for Childermas. East of the city of London lies the suburb of Spitalfields, famed far and wide as a place where wondrous silks are made. There is not now, nor ever will be, silk produced anywhere else in England of so fine a quality as Spitalfields silk. In the past, good houses were built to accommodate the silk merchants, master weavers and dyers who prospered from the trade. But though the silk that comes out of the weavers' attics nowadays is every bit as remarkable as ever it was, Spitalfields itself is much fallen off. Its houses have grown dirty and shabby.
The wealthy merchants have moved to Islington, Clerkenwell, and if they are very wealthy indeed, to the parish of Merrylebone in the west. Today Spitalfields is inhabited by the low and the poor, and is much plagued with small boys, thieves, and other persons inimical to the peace of the citizens. On a particularly gloomy day, when a cold grey rain fell in the dirty streets and pooled in the mud, a carriage came down Elder Street in Spitalfields and stopped at a tall, thin house. The coachman and footman belonging to this carriage wore deep mourning. The footman jumped down from the box, put up a black umbrella, and held it up as he opened the door for Jonathan Strange to get out. Strange paused a moment on the pavement to adjust his black gloves and to cast his glance up and down Elder Street. Apart from two mongrel dogs industriously excavating a heap of refuse, the street was deserted. Yet he continued to look about him until his eye was caught by a doorway on the opposite side of the street. It was the most unremarkable of doorways, the entrance to a merchant's warehouse or some such. Three worn stone steps led up to a massive black door of venerable construction, surmounted by a great jutting pediment. The door was much papered over with tattered playbills and notices, informing the reader that upon such and such a day, at such and such a tavern, all the property of Mr. So-and-so Esquire, bankrupt, would be put up for sale. "George," said Strange to the footman who held the umbrella, "do you draw?"
"I beg your pardon, sir?"
"Were you ever taught drawing? Do you understand its principles, foreground, side screens, perspective, that sort of thing?"
"Me, sir? No, sir."
"A pity. It was part of my education. I could draw you a landscape or portrait perfectly proficient and perfectly uninteresting. Exactly like the productions of any other well-educated amateur. Your late mistress had none of the advantages of expensive drawing masters that I had, yet I believe she had more talent. Her watercolours of people and children would horrify a fashionable drawing master. He would find the figures too stiff and the colours too bright. But Mrs. Strange had a genius for capturing expressions, both of face and figure, for finding charm and wit in the most commonplace situations. There is something in her pictures, altogether lively and pretty, which—" Strange broke off and was silent a moment. "What was I saying? Oh, yes. A drawing teaches habits of close observation that will always be useful. Take that doorway, for instance." The footman looked at the doorway. "Today is cold, dark, rainy. There is very little light and therefore no shadows. One would expect the interior of that doorway to be gloomy and dim. One would not expect that shadow to be there. I mean the strong shadow going from left to right, keeping the left hand of the doorway in utter blackness. And I believe I'm right in saying that even if today were sunny and bright, a shadow would fall in the opposite direction. No, that shadow is altogether an oddity. It is not a thing that appears in nature." The footman looked at the coachman for some assistance, but the coachman was determined not to be drawn in and stared off into the distance.
"I see, sir," said the footman.
Strange continued to regard the doorway with the same expression of thoughtful interest. Then he called out, "Childermas, is that you?" For a moment nothing happened, and then the dark shadow which Strange objected to so strongly moved. It came away from the doorway like a wet sheet being peeled from a bed, and as it did so, it changed and shrank and altered and became a man, John Childermas. Childermas smiled his wry smile.
"Well, sir, I could not expect to stay hidden from you for long."
Strange sniffed.
"I've been expecting you this past week or more. Where have you been?" "My master did not send me until yesterday."
"And how is your master?"
"Oh, poorly, sir. Very poorly. He is beset with colds and headaches and trembling in his limbs. All his usual symptoms when someone has vexed him, and no one vexes him as you do."
"I am pleased to hear it."
"And by the by, sir, I've been meaning to tell you. I have some money at Hanover Square for you. Your fees from the Treasury and the Admiralty for the last quarter of 1814.
Strange opened his eyes in surprise.
"And does Norrell really intend to let me have my share? I'd suppose that money was gone for good."
Childermas smiled.
"Mr. Norrell knows nothing about it. Shall I bring the money tonight?"
"Well, certainly. I shall not be at home, but give it to Jeremy.
Tell me, Childermas, I'm curious. Does Norrell know that you go about making yourself invisible and turning yourself into shadows?" Oh, I've picked up a little skill here and there. I've been 26 years in Mr. Norrell's service. I would have to be a very dull fellow to have learnt nothing at all. Well, yes, of course, but that was not what I asked. Does Norrell know? No, sir. He suspects, but he chooses not to know. A magician who passes his life in a room full of books must have someone to go about the world for him. There are limits to what you can find out in a silver dish of water. You know that. Well, come on, man. See what you were sent to see. The house had a very much neglected, almost deserted air. Its windows and paint were very dirty, and the shutters were all put up. Strange and Childermas waited upon the pavement, while the footman knocked at the door. Strange had his umbrella, and Childermas was entirely indifferent to the rain falling upon him. Nothing happened for some time, and then something made the footman look down into the area, and he began a conversation with someone no one else could see. Whoever this person was, Strange's footman did not think much of them. His frown, his way of standing with both hands on his hips, the manner in which he admonished them, all betrayed the severest impatience. After a while, the door was opened by a very small, very dirty, very frightened servant girl. Jonathan Strange, Childermas, and the footman entered, and as they did so, each glanced down at her, and she, poor thing, was frightened out of her wits to be looked at by so many tall, important-looking people. Strange did not trouble to send up his name. It seemed so unlikely that they could have persuaded the little servant girl to do it. Instead, instructing Childermas to follow him, Strange ran up the stairs and passed directly into one of the rooms. There, in an obscure light made by many candles burning in a sort of fog, for the house seemed to produce its own weather, they found the engraver, Monsieur Minevois, and his assistant, Monsieur Fulcalquier.